states could pull out of the framework convention. That could take a year. But ultimately, I think one of the biggest initial impacts will be if the United States doesn't live up to its fair share of the climate finance.
And the significance of the Brexit leader, Farage, meeting with Donald Trump, the president-elect.
Well, I think it's a sign of the world that we live in, that far-right xenophobes and racists are dominating the political narrative in many, many countries, not just in the United States, in the UK. I think it's a worrying sign. These are all people who deny the climate change, who want to slow down action, who want to continue to protect powerful vested interests in the fossil fuel industry. At the exact moment we need more global solidarity, more coming together, these people are talking about building walls and fences and turning in on ourselves.
Asad Rehman, this is part one of our conversation. Come back tomorrow for part two. That's Asad Rehman, spokesperson for Friends of the Earth International. Quick correction to our headline on the mistrial of former University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing. He shot Sam Dubose in the head, killing him, not in the back. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Marine Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gattas, Dina, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Chirina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winona LaDuc, speaking Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the EMU Ballroom at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Winona LaDuc will speak on nature's historic position as property and the international call to legally recognize nature's right to exist, persist, and naturally evolve. This global movement is dedicated to normalizing the notion of rights of nature. Again, that's Winona LaDuc speaking on the rights of nature, Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the EMU Ballroom on the corner of 19th Avenue and University Street in Eugene. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protests against the newly elected president continue in Portland and around the nation.
The FBI reports an increase in reported hate crimes around the U.S.
And the Portland City Council will hold a public hearing Wednesday on a proposed law to ban new fossil fuel terminals from being built in the city.
Good evening. This is a KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 14, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Protests in Portland over the election of Donald Trump continued through the weekend. After violent confrontations between protesters and police on both Friday and Saturday night, Sunday's protests were largely peaceful. Sunday's peaceful demonstrations were in sharp contrast to Saturday night when protesters clashed with police, who responded by firing tear gas at the protesters and arresting more than 70 people. On Friday night, a protester marching across the Morrison Bridge was shot after a confrontation between protesters and a passing car. Two 18-year-old men were arrested several hours later on attempted murder charges. City officials are claiming the protests have already caused more than $1 million in damages. the protesters have vowed to continue. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales acknowledged the rights of people to protest, but vowed to crack down harshly on those committing violence and vandalism, and said, "Sorry, you don't make change through protest," and urged protesters to seek change through the political system and not the streets.
Portland teenagers walked out of classes and marched to Benson High School. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with students from all over Portland about why they are marching in the street.
I'm with Franklin High School. There are plenty of schools here. I don't remember exactly which ones. Do you know?
There is Cleveland and Benson and most of the Portland. Yeah.
And we are just fighting so that we can make sure our voices are heard. And if you can hear, I lost my voice chanting too loud.
Everyone's getting lost, that's for sure. So how did you coordinate all the schools?
There was a post that went sent around. There was a post that was sent around, and a lot of people saw it and shared it with their friends, and then this was organized.
My name is Peter Fink.
My name is Peter Berdisic.
We go to Cleveland High School, and so Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote. Hillary Clinton won by 1.7 million votes.
Maybe two, they say.
Yeah. Maybe two. And Donald Trump ran a campaign of hate, misogyny, and unwelcoming to all Americans. And I believe that the only America I can know is an America where everyone is included, accepted, and respected. That's not Donald Trump's USA. We're protesting the fact that his policies involve racism, they involve misogyny, they involve the bad treatment of certain citizens who aren't in power, and they also... he's thought of nominating people like Horace Lucas, who is an oil executive, for Secretary of Interior. That would mean that all of the national parks we know would go over to Horace Lucas, who's an oil executive. And that's not what we want for our country.
My name is Peter Perdisic, and I do agree with Peter over here. But another thing that since it's like silver lining with Donald Trump, because he's opened up the windows to see how people think about race and other like women and stuff. And really, this rally promotes happiness, joy, and just love in general. And that's what people are really missing about the message when they just see a bunch of teenage kids just running around crazy. And also, I would like to thank you for coming out.
How many people do you figure are participating? And I guess I should ask you, what other people at your school think about this? Do you have support from your other students who couldn't make it?
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, kids at my school think that everyone that goes to one of these rallies are, like, really kind and really wise, and it's really smart to come to one of these to learn more about your peers and about the people that care about the United States and all other countries.
Thank you so much for that.
Yep, thank you.
We really appreciate talking to you.
On Saturday night, two bathrooms at the Reed College Library were covered in hateful graffiti. The walls were spray-painted with a swastika, profanities, and racist phrases. To find out more, I spoke with Kevin Myers, Director of Strategic Communications at Reed College. Kevin, first, thanks very much for talking with us at KBOO. It must have been a very busy few days since the graffiti appeared on Saturday night. I was wondering who first reported the hateful graffiti, and what was Reed's immediate response?
Yeah, well, thanks for reaching out, Ken. It has been a difficult time, but the community response has really been wonderful. So I'm happy to chat about this. So the initial reports we heard from students. They called our community safety office about just sometime after 8 o'clock, and by 11 p.m. We had already painted over the graffiti, and by midnight, you know, we had had a message out to the community, letting people know if they felt unsafe that, you know, the community safety officers were there to escort them, and that they were going to, you know, sort of up their patrols around campus.
Did any students take advantage of that that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of, no. You know, I think people were, you know, Reed is a fairly small community, and I think people were more or less relying on each other. But I think it was good for them to know that the community safety officers were at the ready and nearby.
Now, the last I heard, the college still doesn't know who's responsible for the graffiti. Is that still the case?
That's correct. We don't know. We have reported the incident to the Portland Police Bureau, and they are investigating this, as a potential hate crime. So Portland, Police Bureau is again, working with us, hopefully to find the perpetrator.
Now, given that it would be labeled as a potential hate crime, do federal authorities come in at that point?
I don't know the answer to that, Kent. I believe that's correct. I think the first thing that happens is Portland investigate it, and then they make that determination as the next steps of who to bring in.
I went to read, as I mentioned to you earlier, and I think Portland knows it, if they know it at all, is a fairly liberal college. So I was wondering who would even have access to the Reed Library, especially on a Saturday night. Obviously not students alone, I would think.
Right. That's correct. Yeah, we don't know that this incident actually took place on Saturday night. We know that it was found on Saturday evening. But as you point out, the library is our most public building. So there's members of the larger community in and out of there all day, every day.
Do you have to be a Reed alumni then to get in, or a student, or can just anybody walk in and use the library?
No, more or less. Anybody can go in and use it, and many people do. It really is kind of a jewel of the neighborhood, that a lot of people do take advantage of.
And again, I mentioned that, of course, the perception, and I think the reality, it's a fairly liberal college. Unfortunately, it may not be as surprising to see something like this at a large university in Oregon like U of O or Oregon State, but absolutely shocking.
That's right. And I mean, I think you've just described the atmosphere on campus. I mean, people are really absolutely shaken. Heartsick is a phrase that I've been hearing a lot. I mean, this kind of behavior really is just antithetical to Reed's values. And, it's just been very difficult for people to come to grips with it. I think nobody really even wants to consider that it was a member of our own community that would do this. I think people are sort of believing that it is somebody who wandered onto campus.
And I'm going to ask you something that probably is not within your purview to answer, but I was wondering if you could attribute any of this open hate speech, again, very rare for Reed, to the recent presidential campaign and the election results?
I would hate to speculate on something like that. Yeah, I would hate to speculate on something like that.
Oh, I don't blame you, but other people have.
I'll leave that to other people. Yeah.
Okay. Well, one last question, Kevin. And again, thanks very much for your time. I was wondering, what are the longer range plans that Reed has to combat this type of hate speech?
Yeah, I think today, starting today, we really came together as a community. There were, a couple of ways for the entire community to gather and really hopefully, gather strength and to move forward. But really, we just have to stand vigilant against any such acts of hatred. And we just don't stand for it. I mean, again, this is really antithetical to Reed's mission and Reed's values. And anybody, who seeking to cause fear or harm to Reed members, should just really expect a very vigorous response. And the kind of response I think that we've shown we're capable of, over the last few days.
We've been talking with Kevin Myers, Director of Strategic Communications at Reed College, about the hateful graffiti found in two Reed College library bathrooms last Saturday night. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
The election of Donald Trump has led to a sense of insecurity in minority communities across the country amid numerous acts of vandalism, violence, and expressions of hostility towards those communities. American Muslims are just one demographic that has been lumped together and demonized. Trump has repeatedly, if inconsistently, called for a ban on immigration to the U.S. from Muslim-majority countries, surveillance of mosques, and encouraged and repeated negative generalizations of Muslims among his supporters. This weekend, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with a mother of three from Redmond, Washington, named Nihal Fuhim. She coordinates an Islamic preschool in Redmond, Washington, and shared her thoughts and experiences in the wake of the election of Donald Trump. These are excerpts of the full interview which will run at 5:45 p.m. tomorrow after the KBOO News.
Being a Muslim and, you know, having this much faith, and that's what I tell my kids, so we just have to have faith and believe in, you know, the system of life and, you know, as a whole. And I always tell them we need to just always do our best, be our best, and pray and hope for the best. And that's what we, that's our motto in life. But I think my main concern, just like any other parent of a minority, not just Muslims here, but like any other parent, I do have a little concern, you know, for my kids, for being exposed, you know, in school. And I feel like when there is always hate speech, there is hate, you know, it kind of fosters some hate crimes. But I'm hoping it's going to calm down. And I always tell my kids, you know, we have to just be honest and be our best and, you know, be kind to others and, you know, expect, you know, just hope for the best. That's pretty much it.
How have your kids reacted to this so far?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. We had a tough election night on for my youngest kids. My teenager is, I'm praying she's strong, and she knew how to deal with it because they have been talking about it in the school, and she kind of knows who's in support and who's not in support. And I think she's at that age where she can, you know, speak up for herself. But my younger ones, my 10-year-old and my 8-year-old, it was a little bit tough on them. And my 10-year-old got an anxiety attack for the first time of her life, and that tore my heart. It took a while, you know. Now she's fine. We talked it over. We emphasized the fact that we're here, and you know, we're part of this system, and we work hard, and we contribute to the community, and here we are, and school, and all that. My 8-year-old, who is less able to express herself, I think, had some anxiety, but not as much as the 10-year-old. But she also got a nightmare in the middle of the night. She woke up. She didn't want to go to school the next morning. Luckily, the principal and the teachers of their school, they're very understanding. And when I talked to them, they were very supportive. And I got an email from my 8-year-old teacher, you know, saying that, you know, any concern of Jenna, and if she had, you know, whatever she has, I'm going to take care of it. And she was really nice. So I thank God for that, for sure.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
The only thing I'd like to add is I wish that elected officials and candidates, when they talk about Islam and Muslims, they really think about the effect of their words on everyday lives of millions of American Muslim children growing up across our nation. And it is definitely appreciated when leaders publicly and vocally stand up and affirm American values of religious freedom, publicly and vocally tell stories of lives and contributions of the American Muslims they know, you know, to give hope to millions of American Muslim children growing up across the country.
That was Nihal Fahim, a mother of three and coordinator of an Islamic preschool in Redmond, Washington, speaking with KBOO reporter Sam Bowman. Speaking with KBOO tomorrow at 5:45 for the full interview.
Hundreds of protesters gathered at Capitol Park in protest of Capitol building in Salem this weekend. The Capitol building in Salem water protectors in North Dakota. For the water KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama was there.
While America's attention has been focused on the recent presidential election, the resistance over the North Dakota Access Pipeline over the North Dakota Access locally, protesters from all over Oregon gathered at the protest building in Capitol State Park in Salem opening weekend to voice their opposition to the ongoing construction.
We have reached 400 parts per million. We have reached carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and parties are in the atmosphere. Mother Earth will not be able to sustain life. Mother General, and then I'm a large general. I heard 90% of animal disease is preparing by 2020. Animals will be tested, so that is why I am here. I'm standing to stand. That is why I am returning to Mother Earth and the water of life. Protect Mother Earth.
How many spills do we need? Well, we will be happy to drink oil. Oil is contamination. I mean, it's a pipeline 1 week ago that exploded from
cat that backed up into it. One person dead, two people severely burned.
If we stand united with everybody, if we spread the word, if we at least educate people on things that are going on that maybe they don't know about, maybe it'll touch somebody that can do something, you know? So I'm here to stand with Standing Rock and to support our future generations and to protect Mother Earth.
For the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which I'm a member of, and so even though I'm born here, having, you know, good, clean drinking water is important, and coming from the reservation, there's not much there, so we got to protect what they have, and water is essential for life.
I stand with Standing Rock. I want clean water for our people, for our children, for, you know, for everybody, and I just, you know, I'm Lakota, I'm Native American myself, and it's just a really, you know, strong emotional thing for me, and I just say I want to do anything I can.
Event organizer Leslie Bradley.
I am an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. It is my tribe that is standing there, and I wanted to show my solidarity and standing with them, even though I couldn't go there. And I know so many other people want to go there, but they can't, but they want to show their support. And so this was for those people, too, who wanted to speak up and say, I support them. I cannot go there, but I support them.
So as we're here in front of the Capitol building, you know, this is where all our lawmakers are. What are you hoping they take as action steps to help support the Standing Rock protesters?
Well, our current lawmakers in the state of Oregon also need to look at what we're doing currently here in Oregon. There is another protest on the 14th that is protesting the LNG pipeline down in Jordan Cove, down in Klamath Falls area. And there's some permits pending there, so I'd like them to take a look at those permits and say, can we block this? I mean, it's not good for us either. It's not good for Standing Rock. It's not good for all the people who live near these waters and rivers that we're trying to go under and over and frack and do these easements to make it possible for them. They need to look at the easements. The easements are a real issue. As currently is happening right now in Standing Rock, they're continuing to pursue the Dakota Access Line, even though they don't have one of the easements that they need.
Actions against the pipeline continue to take place around the world, including sit-in protests against those companies funding the pipeline. In North Dakota, water protectors are still being met with physical force by law enforcement and private security. There are no plans to leave the construction site by either side as water protectors prepare to stay through the upcoming North Dakota winter. There is a nationwide day of action planned for tomorrow, November 15th. For the KBOO News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Uhuru Sasa Culture Club's youth panel, which invites youth to dialogue with the prisoners in hope that they can learn from the poor choices prisoners have made and regret. At 6, it's Labor Radio, one of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, presenting a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and challenging the status quo. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, views and news from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain, low about 52, calm wind becoming south 5 to 9 miles per hour in the evening. Chance of precipitation is 100%. Tomorrow, showers. High near 56, chance of precipitation is 100%. Today in history, in 1889, Nellie Bly, the pioneer of investigative journalism, set off from New York to go around the world faster than the fictional character Phineas Fogg from Jules Verne's novel Around the World in 80 Days. She succeeded, returning to New York in the record time of 72 days. The quote of the day is from the late John Mitchell, Attorney General under the disgraced President Richard Nixon, who said, "You'd be better informed if, instead of listening to what we say, you watch what we do."
This Wednesday, the Portland City Council will hold a public meeting on a proposed law to ban new fossil fuel terminals from being built in the city. The law would also limit the ability of the 11 existing fuel terminals to expand in the future. The ordinance would apply to all fuel terminals that hold more than 2 million gallons of fuel at any one time. More than 700 people have already commented or testified on the proposed ordinance, and this Wednesday's public meeting will be held at 10:45 a.m. at City Hall, located at 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue in downtown Portland. The City Council is expected to vote on the proposed terminal ban in early December.
The City of Portland Neighborhood Small Grants Program has almost $100,000 to give out in grants to neighborhood and community organizations for community engagement projects in 2017. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Kelly Federson about how grassroots efforts might get funding through the Small Grants Program.
This is Jenka Soderberg, and I'm live here in the studio today with Kelly Federson from the Southeast Uplift, that is part of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and are here to tell us about the Neighborhood Small Grants Program. Can you just start by giving us an overview of the City of Portland's Neighborhood Small Grants Program?
Of course, I'd love to. So the grant program is citywide, and it is administered by each of the 7 neighborhood coalitions in the City of Portland. Each one does it slightly differently, but the focus of it is to really spur civic engagement, provide opportunities for hands-on involvement, and allow communities to identify their own issues, develop project proposals, and implement them. And this year, Southeast Uplift has over $23,000 available for community groups, project teams, nonprofit organizations to apply.
And what kind of projects are funded by these grants?
Such a wide range. I think that's one of the most exciting pieces of this grant program. We have everything from social justice art projects, street murals, leadership trainings, community gardens, basically anything that increases the number and diversity of people who are engaged in their community, projects that build community capacity to create social change, and then projects that increase the voice of the people in public decision making.
Do you know of what projects have gotten funding through this grant program in the past?
Yeah, we've had organizations ranging from Portland Mercado. We've had VOES. So since we're in Southeast, I'm going to be naming a lot of Southeast organizations. Know Your City with the Jade Journal recently. We've had some neighborhood associations. And then sometimes it's just community groups. You don't have to be a formal organization. You can basically form a team to do a project.
And how? What's the grant process? What types of things do people have to prepare and by when?
So applications are due January 10th, but I think one of the most unique things about this program is it's really accessible to first-time grant writers. We provide a lot of hands-on support, so we have 2 grant workshops coming up on November 19th and November 20th. In addition to that, we are willing to meet one-on-one with you to go over your project idea. We'll review your draft application. And then if you get grant funding, we're there to help you through the process. And for us, it's not so much about whether or not you achieved X set of people engaged or if you set some sort of metrics. It's more about the capacity building aspect and kind of you doing something out in the community, whether or not it succeeds in the normal sense or not.
And when should people start applying?
Whenever. I'm ready to receive your applications now. And if you do submit early, you'll give me time to basically give you feedback if anything's missing. But the last day to apply would be January 10th.
And people can go online. Is it at the Southeast Uplift website to find information?
Yes. So you could go to our website if you're going to be applying within our coalition boundaries, which is everything from the river to basically 82nd Avenue and Milwaukee to I-84. And then each of the other coalitions also has different programs that you can look at, or you can just go straight to the Office of Neighborhood Involvement website if you want to see an overview of our area where you can see all programs.
And this is funded by the city of Portland, right?
Yes, it is. It's the 10th year. It is always on the chopping block, though. It's one of the first things to go since it's technically a pretty small amount of money, but our community groups leverage that funding at least four times over. So if we're giving out a grant of $1,000, usually the community groups are able, through in-kind donations and volunteer time, matching it with about $4,000.
And it's $100,000 citywide. Correct. And then divided by neighborhoods.
By coalitions, yeah.
So how were those coalitions chosen, and what's the Southeast Uplift? Are you a nonprofit?
We are a nonprofit, primarily funded through the Office of Neighborhood Involvement through city funding, but we're an independent organization. We have our own board of directors, and we're really charged with trying to increase civic engagement in that area of Portland. We work with community groups, just everyday Portlanders, and neighborhood associations within our coalition boundaries through advocacy, community building projects, events, and programs like our small grant program to engage the community members in shaping the future of our city.
And the other organizations involved in the other sectors, East Portland Neighborhood Office, Central Northeast Neighbors, North Portland Neighborhood Services, are they similar type organizations?
They are. We all have very similar missions. We're structured slightly differently. Five out of the seven are nonprofit organizations, and two are actually city staff.
And so as far as this this grant program, is this something that you see as addressing some of the inequities in our city and the problems that are faced by some of these different neighborhoods?
We really hope so, and we really prioritize funding projects that really enhance the voice and leadership of what we consider underrepresented groups. So that's everything from communities of color, LGBTQ, renters, low income, individuals with disability, immigrants and refugees. So we highly prioritize groups that are represented within that, because we see a huge need for their voices to be at the table.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly Feddersen with Southeast Uplift, talking about the Neighborhood Small Grant Program here in Portland. And the grants applications, again, are due on January 10th, but don't wait. Get started now, and you can find out more on the Southeast Uplift site, seuplift.org. That's seuplift.org. You can also look, if you're interested in another part of the city other than Southeast, at the Office of Neighborhood Involvement if you go to portlandoregon.gov. Kelly, thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Methodist Episcopal Church is encouraging congregations to reduce global warming pollution and make the issue part of the conversation. That's today's Climate Connection.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. One of the oldest and largest black churches in America has taken a stand against climate change. The African Methodist Episcopal Church, or AME, has 7,000 congregations and 2.5 million members. Jacqueline DuPont Walker, co-author of the AME's resolution on climate change, says members of their congregations around the world are already affected. For example, by droughts and floods in Zimbabwe, warm temperatures in Alaska, and flooding in Louisiana.
We generally provide ministry in communities that are extremely diverse, but people also have a challenge of not having wealth. So if someone is going to pay attention to the issue of climate change for the communities where we serve, we believe we are called to do this.
So the church is calling on its congregations to integrate climate change into its teachings for adults and children. The resolution also asked them to reduce global warming pollution and to make the issue part of daily conversation.
And we will be actively engaged in trying to impact policy at the local level and at every level of government.
Becoming a voice for communities worldwide that are affected by climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Reports of hate crimes and racial attacks have gone up in the days following Tuesday's election. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there have been over 300 reported attacks in the last week alone. A newly released FBI report shows that hate attacks against Muslims increased by 67% in 2015. According to the FBI, law enforcement reported a total of 5,850 hate crime incidents in the U.S. for all of 2015. The Justice Department also reported separately that less than 50% of all violent offenses committed in 2015 were ever actually reported to police, so it's likely that the actual number of hate crimes was much higher. In an interview with CBS on Sunday, President-elect Trump told his supporters to, quote, stop it. Here in the Portland area, racist graffiti was reported at Reed College, while incidents of verbal assaults have been reported through social media.
President-elect Donald Trump, and you have no idea how difficult that is for me to say, is entangled in multiple lawsuits. Among them are a Chicago case accusing his campaign of spam text messages and a series of suits over Trump University. In addition, he's also in the midst of an IRS tax audit, ongoing investigations into his charitable foundation, and an investigation into alleged links to Russia. While sitting presidents have immunity from litigation arising from official actions, the immunity does not extend to their private conduct or to their conduct before taking office. Students of Trump University who paid up to $35,000 to learn real estate investing secrets have brought a class action lawsuit. Students from California, Florida, and New York allege that the program violated laws against defrauding customers and the elderly. That trial is set to begin November 28th in San Diego. If the case, which has been pending for 6 years, comes to trial, Trump will face Judge Gonzalo Curiel, the very judge Trump accused of being biased against him because of his Latino heritage. According to USA Today, Trump businesses have faced at least 3,500 legal actions in federal and state courts over the years.
A commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal on the presidential election results in the United States.
Shock and awe. I didn't see this coming. The words I never thought I'd say, President Trump, have become reality. In a remarkable campaign full of bile, hatred, fear, and loathing, guess what? Fear won. Hatred now gulps a glass of champagne. This campaign has been marked by scenes we have never seen before, by words we've never heard said on TV or radio, by screams about a rigged system, folks. When a billionaire shouts about a rigged system, you better believe it, because it is, but in his favor, not against him. Donald Trump has received billions of dollars in free cable and media coverage, which lifted his campaign from farce into solidity. After every campaign stop, the strains of a song, "You can't always get what you want," was heard. It is now clear, you can't. Today, a new day dawns on America as a curtain falls over the Obama presidency and Clintonism. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Following his victory last week, Donald Trump has formed a transition team and is beginning to name people to his administration. Steve Bannon, the Breitbart News chairman who's widely regarded as being racist and anti-Semitic, has been named as a top White House advisor. Steve Mnuchin, a Goldman Sachs banker, is a leading candidate for Secretary of the Treasury. David Bernhardt, who worked in the Interior Department under the George W. Bush administration, will lead the Interior Department transition team. Sarah Palin, famous for her drill, baby drill mantra, is the likely nominee to head the Interior Department. Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus has been named as the future White House Chief of Staff. Priebus rose through the ranks of the Wisconsin Republican Party and is a Scott Walker ally. One of America's top climate change deniers, Myron Abell, will lead the Environmental Protection Agency's transition to the Trump presidency. Abell has repeatedly stated he believes global warming is a hoax. Michael McKenna, a longtime lobbyist for Koch Industries and Dow Chemical, has been named to run the Energy Department transition team. More names, all winners, I guess, are expected to be announced soon.
According to a recent World Bank study, natural disasters drive 26 million people into poverty each year. The World Bank studied 117 countries and published its findings at their climate change conference in Marrakesh. The study also set the monetary cost of floods, droughts, and storms at $520 billion a year. Previous studies by the bank set the cost of natural disasters much lower because they only measured damage to physical assets. Once the loss of consumption of poor people was considered, the cost grew much higher. Due to fewer resources, the impact to the health and education of marginalized people are at greater risk, the study stated. Jim Kim, the World Bank's president, pointed out the necessity of protecting the world's most vulnerable against the effects of global warming, saying, "Severe climate shocks threaten to roll back decades of progress against poverty." Kim added, "Building resistance to disasters not only makes economic sense, it is a moral imperative."
As the second week of international climate talks continue in Morocco, the World Meteorological Organization announced that 2016 would officially be the hottest on record. The average global temperature was 1.2 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than pre-industrial levels. Temperatures in the Arctic, however, have increased at a much faster rate. Temperatures in the Russian Arctic have increased by an average of almost 11 degrees Fahrenheit, and temperatures in the American and Canadian Arctic have increased by more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit already. Donald Trump has vowed to pull the United States out of the recently negotiated Paris Climate Accord, an agreement most climate scientists believe will not stop a 2 degrees Celsius temperature increase. 2 degrees Celsius is more than 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. The UN's climate change envoy, former President of Ireland Mary Robinson, responded that the U.S. would be seen as a rogue nation if Trump follows through with his threat to pull the country out of the Paris Climate Accord. Trump has also announced that one of America's top climate change deniers, Myron Abell, would lead the Environmental Protection Agency's transition to the Trump presidency. Abell has repeatedly stated he believes global warming is a hoax.
The South Island of New Zealand was struck by two earthquakes measuring over 7 on the Richter scale yesterday. They were followed by over 300 aftershocks peaking at 6.2 and continuing throughout the afternoon. The two largest tremors, measured at 7.4 and 7.8, were felt throughout the country. 2.5-meter waves lapped at the eastern coast of the islands, but the predicted larger tsunami waves failed to appear. The quakes were centered northeast of Christchurch, where 185 people were killed in a smaller quake in 2011. Two people have been killed so far in yesterday's event, with damage estimated, and some scientists in New Zealand worry the earthquake could trigger others as large or larger in the next month, since it occurred on a previously unknown fault and likely placed stress on the intersection of the Pacific and Australian plates. Meanwhile, a 6.2 quake struck in northwest Argentina mere hours after the largest New Zealand earthquake. No damage or injuries have yet been reported from that event, which occurred in a primarily rural area.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, Joe Lino, Sam Bowman, Ken Jones, Jenka Soderberg, and Don Zur. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Chris Andre and to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, it's Alternative Radio. Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist and author of The Punishment of Gaza, reports on the never-ending occupation of Palestine. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, D. May Roberts speaks with members of Passin Art, a theater company, about their upcoming production of Black Nativity. And at 11:30, it's Art Focus with host Andre Middleton. Thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate. There are a number of culture clubs at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem, Oregon. KBOO host Karen James spoke to members of the Uhuru Sasa Culture Club at their youth panel that invites youth to dialogue with the prisoners in hope that they can learn from the poor choices prisoners have made and regret.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm here at the Oregon State Penitentiary with Jamie Henderson and Harold Jones from the Uhuru Sasa Culture Club. Harold, what is the Uhuru Sasa Culture Club here at OSP?
The Uhuru Sasa Cultural Club, which stands